Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Fidelity Bank First Half 2019 Earnings Call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions later during the conference. If you should need assistance during the call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero. Please note this call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to Nnamdi Ukwuankwo. Please go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this call. With me today are executive management team members. I'll go straight to the first part of the presentation by reviewing the H1 performance. Okay. Our performance for the period showed a decent double-digit growth on key performance indices like gross earnings, fee income, profitability, loans, deposits, and equity. We achieved 15.1 billion PBT for the period, and that was a growth of 15.7% when compared with H1 of last year. However, if you compare Q1 and Q2, we achieved 25.5% growth between those two quarters. Now, the growth in PBT is attributable to 52.4% growth in fee income, and this led to an absolute growth of 5.3 billion and a net impairment write-back of 0.8 billion, which led to a positive variance of 3.4 billion. I'll be explaining this net impairment write-back shortly. The absolute growth of 8.7 billion in both fee income and impairment offset the combined negative variance, which totaled 6.7 billion. And this 6.7 billion came from negative variance on net interest income, which came in at negative of 1.2 billion, and expenses, which came in at 5.5 billion. So let me speak about this impairment write-back and net losses on the recognition of financial assets measured at amortized cost. Starting with the gross impairment write-back on the financials was actually 5.5 billion. Now, this 5.5 billion included a 4 billion naira impairment write-back on an asset. This impairment was no longer needed, so we wrote back that 4 billion. However, in giving the IFRS treatment, a net loss of 4.7 billion on the derecognition of financial assets measured at amortized cost was now charged on the same asset, thus giving the net that you see there. This is in line with IFRS 9 treatment, and that particular loan has now moved from stage 2 to stage 1 after this treatment. Continuing, our ROE came in at 13.5% and is on track with our 13% guidance for this year. NIM improved to 5.8% from 5.1% in Q1 of this year. This improvement was largely driven by increase in average yield on earning assets to 13.5%, with funding costs remained flat. Total deposits increased by 12% to 1.09 trillion, driven again by double-digit growth in both local and foreign currency deposits. But in absolute terms, total deposits grew by about 118 billion on account of 19.9% growth in foreign currency deposits and 10.2% growth in local currency deposits. Our retail strategy continues to show that we're on the right track. Savings deposits grew 8.6% to 248 billion approximately, and now savings accounts for approximately 23% of our total deposits. In the area of digital strategy, we continue to see progress, with 45% of our customers now enrolled on our mobile and internet banking products, and digital now contributes 29% of fee-based income. Our risk assets grew by 17.6% year to date to 999.3 billion. And this was primarily driven by four key sectors that accounted for over 95%. And those sectors are manufacturing, transport, agri, and oil and gas. Of course, manufacturing is one of the largest beneficiaries. And I'll tell you why. They are one of the largest beneficiaries of intervention funds for on-lending facilities. And this has been one of the key sources we use to access alternative and cheaper funding for our clients to drive business. Those are the corporate end. As you know, they will not borrow at those very high rates. So we use intervention funds to cushion the cost for them and retain them. Okay, from a portfolio breakdown perspective, our loan book is broken down as stage 1 is now 74.7%, stage 2, 19.9%, stage 3, 5.4%. So our stage 3 loans increased by 9.7%, NPL improved to 5.4%, down from 5.7% as at 2018 financial year end. And this was due to growth in the gross loan book, which was about 15.8%. Key sectors responsible for growth in our stage 3 loans were oil and gas, manufacturing, and general commerce. You recall that these areas we keep saying some of our key focus areas. NPL guidance for the year still remains below 6%, and we're working hard to achieve that. On capital adequacy, our ratios remained above the threshold, with CAR now at 17% and liquidity ratio at almost 35%. Cost income ratio, the tough point, so we have our eyes on the ball and we're working hard to make sure that we bring it down. We are not unaware of the importance of making sure that we bring down that cost income ratio. So I'll stop at this point and then hand over to by the way, Bolaho is now confirmed an executive director of the bank by the Central Bank of Nigeria. So that's actually effective 1st of September. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Nandi. I'll just go straight to slide 3. Slide 4, just gives an overview of the bank. Total assets are now at 1.94 trillion. That's about 12% growth from where we ended in 2018. Staff strength is still below 3,000, 55%, 45% male and female. 4.8 million accounts, about 2.2 million of those customers are now using our mobile and internet banking channels, and about 2.1 million cards. If you go to slide 5, we just showed our progress on retail and digital banking. Over the last 6 months, account acquisition has grown by 7%. The savings deposit base is up by 9%. We've seen an uptick in the retail loan book by about 4%. On mobile and internet banking, customer acquisition is up by about 13% and cards by about 6%. By the end of this year, we expect to have another year of double-digit growth in savings deposits. That should be about the sixth consecutive year. The retail loans are gradually picking up with the launch of some of our new digital lending products. We launched a new product, Fidelity Fast Loan, to cater for different segments. 45% of the customers now on the mobile and internet banking channels. 82% of customer transactions are done on electronic channels, and like Nandi said earlier, 29% of fee-based income now comes from the digital banking business. I'll go to slide 9, which just shows the key performance highlights. Nandi spoken about a lot of this. Cost of risk is at negative 0.2% because of the net write-back we had. And NPLs are 5.4%, driven mainly by the growth in the loan book. Total coverage ratio is 94.9%, but when I get to the loan portfolio, we look at the coverage ratio for the different segments. FCY loans are 39.1% of the loan book. It's now below 40%. It was 41% at the end of the last financial year, and that's due to the stronger growth in the local currency loan book. Capital adequacy ratio is at 17%. Right now, we're recognizing only 40% of the local currency bond. And then loans to interest-bearing liabilities about 65.8%, with total equity at about 216 billion. I'm on slide 10 now, and just key explanations for what's driving the growth. Gross earnings growth driven by credit-related fees, FX income, trade income, digital banking income, and account maintenance fees. Each of those lines grew by above 20%, and then interest income on loans was up by 10%. Net interest margin came in at 5.8%. It's flat when you compare it to the 2018 financial year, but it's an improvement on the 5.1% we recorded in Q1. That's basically due to the improvement in the yield on earning assets to 13.5% over the period. This was basically driven by a 22% growth in interest income in Q2. OPEX went up by 8.7%, and a lot of that was largely driven by four expense lines: staff, advert, and then regulatory charges, AMCON and NDIC. The last two driven by the growth in the balance sheet and then the growth in the deposit base. I'm not really spoken about the gross impairment write-back. It was a 5.5 billion, and then that 5.5 billion included an impairment write-back of 4 billion on a specific asset that had a modification. So what the auditors did in line with IFRS 9 treatment was they recognized a net loss on the derecognition of financial assets measured at amortized cost of 4.7 billion. So included in that 5.5 billion is the 4 billion impairment write-back on that specific asset that the 4.7 billion net loss on derecognition was charged on. So PBT was up 15.7% to 15.1 billion. Customer deposits getting closer to the 1.1 trillion mark, basically driven by both local and foreign currency deposit growth. Domiciliary deposits now about 20% of total deposits at about 216 billion. LDR were above the threshold that was set for banks as at the end of September, which is 60%, but that doesn't mean we'll slow down lending, but still in line with our risk acceptance criteria. CAR improved to 17% because of an 11.4 billion growth in Tier 1 capital, a 10.2 billion growth in fair value reserves, and then the single obligor limit charge we take reduced by 4.5 billion because of the growth in our single obligor limit over the period due to the capitalization of earnings. If you go to slide 12, it just looks at the key lines, H1 2018 from a P&L perspective and H1 2019. Positive variances on a lot of the lines, especially on the fee income lines. Total interest income was up 7.2%. You see the pressure coming from the interest income on liquid assets, basically due to the lower yields over the period. So that was largely flat at 0.1%, but interest income on loans was up 10%. And then growth in interest expense outpaced that at 16.5%. So net interest income was down 3%. PBT, we've spoken about that already, and then we'll go to the balance sheet on slide 13. So earning assets were up 14.5%. Marked reduction in cash holding. Cash reserve were carrying about 308 billion on that line. And then all the deposit products were up apart from demand deposits that went down about 1.8%. But you see the effect of that in trade income that grew significantly. Slide 14 just shows a breakdown of gross earnings on a year-on-year basis and a quarter-on-quarter basis. You see an improvement in most of the lines. I think the lowest growth line is the interest income on liquid assets. Slide 15 explains our net interest margin. So it had been declining for about four consecutive quarters, and then it started to inch up now. We're guided for 6 to 6.5% this year. We're still behind the guidance, but we think there will be an increase in both funding costs and asset yields in Q4 due to the significant fixed income maturities coming up. But if you look at it, funding costs were flat at 6.6%, and then we're able to improve the yield on earning assets from 12.6% to 13.5%, and that's what's responsible for the movement in NIM from 5.1% back to 5.8%. On expense, 16.9% growth year-on-year. H1 was 38.2 billion, Staff costs at NDIC, AMCON, and ADVAC were responsible for almost 80% of the OPEX growth. We guided for below 70% this year. We still intend to work that down over the next two quarters. Slide 18 is just an analysis of the funding base, and then apart from demand deposits that I spoke on earlier on, you will see an improvement in all the other funding sources. Slide 19 speaks of the deposit base. Local currency deposits, roughly now about 80% of the deposit base. We've seen strong growth from the foreign currency deposit base from about 113 billion in H1 2018. It's almost doubled to 216 billion in H1 2019. Slide 20 just shows the retail banking book analysis. Savings deposits are 248 billion. Typically, third quarter is normally one of the slowest quarters for us because of the holiday period, but we expect that to pick up significantly in the fourth quarter. Retail loans are gradually picking up after we launched our new digital lending product and also deepening some of the lending partnerships we have with select fintech. From a retail deposit perspective, it contributes 40% of low-cost deposits. At the liquidity position, net loans to customer deposits is about 69.7%. Our liquidity ratio is about 35%. And then you look at the mixture of our liquid assets, there's no over concentration in any box, so we can take advantage of maturities if there are positive variances in interest rate movement. Slide 22 shows a breakdown of the loan book, 906 billion to $1,050, 143 billion growth over the period, about 15.8%. And you look at the loan portfolio, from a net loan perspective, the growth was about 17.6%. 50% of that loan growth was coming from the transport segment, from the manufacturing segment. Transport segment about 21%, agri about 14%, and then oil and gas another 13.5%. Just like Mandy explained earlier, manufacturing is one of the largest beneficiaries of the intervention funds, and we've used that a lot for some of our corporate and commercial names that have a CAPEX requirement. FCY loans grew by 12% and 39% of the loan book. Slide 25, what we've done here is just to show a breakdown of the loan book by the various stages, stage 1, stage 2, and stage 3. So out of the 1 trillion gross loan book, about 75% of the loan book is in stage 1, 19.9% in stage 2, and 5.4% is in stage 3, which is basically what we have as our NPL book. The coverage ratio for the stage 1 loans is 0.5%, stage 2, 9.3%, and stage 3, 48.5%. A lot of the net impairment write-backs we have for H1 are coming from the stage 1 and stage 2 book. So NPL, which is our stage 3 loans, declined to 5.4%, basically due to the growth in the loan book. The stage 3 loans have gone up to 56.6 billion. Major sectors responsible, oil and gas manufacturing and general commerce. And then we had major reductions in the transport and education sector. NPL guidance for the year still remains at 6%. Slide 27 just shows the variance and the movement in the various sectors from an NPL perspective. And you look at the largest movement, we've seen a decline of almost 43% from the transport sector. And then oil and gas manufacturing and general commerce are the sectors that have the highest move. On slide 29, you look at the capital. So the capital moved from 16.7% to 17%. And then you see the regulatory adjustment is a significant decline from 16.3 billion to 11.8 billion. That's about 4.5 billion. A lot of that driven by the improvement in the single obligor limit because of the growth in the shareholders' funds. We recognize now only 40% of local debt in the Tier 2 capital computation. The CAR is above what the regulatory and our internal guidance limit. Slide 30 shows the contribution of the various business segments. In the corporate and investment banking, you get about 36% of profitability. From the Lagos area, about 29%, 11% from the north, and 24% from the southern part of the country. Slide 32 shows how we've done on guidance for the year. For net interest margin and cost income ratio, we have behind targets on the two. On the other seven indices, we are firmly on track. Thank you, and we'll now take questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if anyone would like to ask a question, you're welcome to press star and then one on a touchtone phone or the keypad on your screen. If you, however, wish to withdraw your question, you may press star and then two to remove yourself from the question queue. If anyone would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. Our first question is from Ola Warikuru of SBG Securities.
Hello, thank you very much for the presentation and congratulations on the results. I just had a few questions. The first one was in relation to asset growth. So if we look at other banking reports as our half year, Fidelity seems to be bucking the trend in that respect, especially with loan growth and the fact that the loan growth is coming from various sectors. So there's been the mention of the intervention funds for some of those key sectors, but then there's still growth across other other sectors. So I guess my question really is, what is Fidelity seeing that the rest of the market isn't? Secondly, in regards to asset quality, it seems to be under control. But then when you look at the stage two loans, specifically power sector seems to be taking up about half of that. And I'm just wondering if you can just elaborate on the exposures in the power sector and also what mitigants are being put in place that it doesn't cause a blowout for cost of risk and for NPLs in, you know, a couple of months down the line. Finally, I wanted to ask about what's driving growth in the domiciliary accounts and also the term deposits, because that seemed to have been there was quite a growth with term deposits which impacted interest expense. So that'll be all my questions for now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. On the loan growth, I think we've had to answer this on a lot of our calls. What are we seeing that other people are not seeing? I think over the last 4 or 5 years, we have consistently continued to lend, even when you strip out the effect of devaluation on the loan book. We've looked at each of the sectors from a risk assessment criteria, from a credit portfolio review, the sectors we're comfortable with, we've been lending to those sectors. The intervention fund covers quite a bit of sectors. Obviously, the manufacturing sector has been one of the better beneficiaries. In the oil and gas segment, we've also seen an uptick in activities when the oil prices improve from a services perspective. In terms of the stage two loan book, if you look at that slide that has the breakdown of the loan book, you will see that the coverage on the stage two loan book is also high. The coverage on the stage two loan book is about 9%. Yes, you're right, about 50% of the loans in the stage two book is the power portfolio. One of the reasons why those loans were there was because we had to restructure a couple of them, but we think from a coverage perspective, that's more than adequate. In terms of domiciliary deposit growth, I think three things are driving it. We've spoken about them earlier. Number one is we've seen a lot of growth from the retail segment on that. On our mobile app, there was an integration we did with Swift where you do domiciliary transfers to any bank in the world, and it takes roughly about 15, 20 minutes. So it's almost instant. Number two is we've seen an increase in the level of liquidity of the customers we have in the oil and gas segment. Obviously, that has been driven by the higher oil prices, and the cash flow of those customers has improved. And number three is just from various trade businesses we do. And then when you look at what some of the customers are doing, we're also seeing, apart from corporate and commercial clients, we're also seeing quite a number of clients also saving money from a domiciliary deposit perspective. Do we think this is going to continue? Yes, but maybe not at the same aggressive growth rate going forward. Thank you.
Our next question is from Tolu Alamutu of Telima.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the call and for taking questions. I have a few questions, please. The first is on the single obligor exposure, which you mentioned. Could you maybe tell us what sector it is and what the current total exposure is, maybe as a percentage of loans or as a percentage of capital? And is this the same obligor that you're taking a charge against capital for? You mentioned that the charge against Tier 1 capital has decreased during the quarter. Secondly, on costs, obviously the cost income ratio was quite high, especially for Q2. If we calculate it, it's around 90 something percent just for the second quarter. Could you maybe give us a little bit more detail on what the bank is doing to bring costs down in the next couple of quarters, and how much confidence you have about meeting the four-year 70% cost-income ratio target? Thirdly, on asset quality and loan growth, there seems to be a little bit of overlap between the sectors generating increased NPLs and the sectors where you've also seen increased loan growth, for instance, oil and gas services and downstream oil and gas. Can you maybe explain to us why you're comfortable still lending to those sectors, even though NPLs seem to be rising? And then on capital, you mentioned that you now only include 40% of the Naira-denominated issue within Tier 2. What is Fidelity Bank considering in terms of replacing that? Could you maybe look to the dollar market as an alternative? And finally, just a broader strategy question. There's clearly a little bit of a push towards more consolidation in the sector, given what the CBN has said about recapitalizing banks and so on over the next 5 years. Given that backdrop, do you think that Fidelity Bank can remain independent in this market, or do you see yourselves partnering with a larger peer? Thank you.
Okay. Nandi will take the question on the broader strategy about capital. I'll take the other ones. Let me start from the capital question. In terms of the exposure, it's in the upstream segment. It was a foreign currency loan. It's still a foreign currency loan. And it's a syndicated facility. We're part of the syndicate. The loan was granted when the exchange rate was actually 150. So when the exchange rate moved to 300, it went above single obligor. So at the time the loan was granted, it was about 70% of our single obligor limit. But obviously, with the exchange rate moving from 150 to 360 in Naira terms, the loan has actually doubled. Single obligor limit is 20% of our shareholders' funds. If you take that loan as a percentage of our capital now, it's about 25% of our capital. So typically, the charge you take is the loan, the balance on the loan, it's subtracted from the single obligor limit, and then the difference is what you take as a capital charge. So two ways to bring down our capital charge is you get pay downs on the loans, that's number one. And then number two is you have an increase in your single obligor limit, which you get through the capitalization of earnings. On some of the sectors you've spoken about, if you look at some of the sectors that you said are driving NPL and we're still lending, for some, for example, the downstream sector, I think on about three or four calls ago, about 80 to 85% of the NPLs in that sector is from one single exposure. I think that was largely in the media because we took the obligor to EFCC. So for some of them, it's quite, there's some level of concentration there, which is not reflective of the fact that maybe you have 40 obligors and then you have one that has gone bad, but that one was material in terms of the NPL book. So I think we're still comfortable with those sectors we're lending to. Obviously, from an NPL formation, if you look over the last 4 or 5 years, even in terms of maturity of the loan book, if there were going to be issues, they would have bubbled up in the last 5 years since we've been lending to those sectors.
Speaking about the broader strategy about whether we'll be looking for opportunities to combine and things like that, you will recall that our 5-year strategy, which ends 2022, was actually crafted around organic growth. So then we are not an unresponsive organization, and we know that the environment keeps changing. So we won't shut our doors to any discussions at all, so long as it aligns with our strategies, and so long as we see synergy, we can consider whatever option comes our way and then keep the market informed. But as it stands, we've crafted this 5-year strategy around organic growth. But again, I repeat, we will not just block ourselves away from whatever comes up. You know. So I think that is it. Thank you.
So just a follow-up, if I may. Is this single obligor the same exposure on which you took the charges through the income statement, or is it completely different?
It's a totally different loan. So if you look at the one that we took the charge through the income statement, that's a 29 billion exposure. If you look at our financial statement, it's clearly stated there on note 10 on our financial statement. So it's different. Thank you
very much.
Our next question is from Emmanuel Adeleke of ARM Securities.
Thanks for taking my questions. I have a few questions to ask today. The first one is, aside the write-back that was done on the restructured loan exposure, I want to believe there are other write-backs, and can you just tell us what sectors are these write-backs, and do we expect more recoveries over the rest of the year? And the second question is on your loan growth. How much of the loan growth over the year is made up of the online facilities? And when you look at the overall loan book now, how much of the loan book does these online facilities make up? And the third question is, I noticed a very strong increase in our term deposits. Things increased by 62% year-to-date, with CASA mix also declining from its 1.6% as at FY18 to 73.7%. So I was actually hoping to see that early trend maintained for the rest of the year. So can you just shed light on this sudden increase, and do we expect to see this trend continue over the rest of the year? And then the last question I have here is, can you just shed light on the 10.2 billion growth in your fair value reserve? Those are my questions for now. Thanks.
Okay. I'll start with the provisions. So gross impairment was 5.5 billion. If you take out the 4 billion, then you have 1.5 billion left. If you look at the decline in the NPL book, the stage 3 loans, you see a marked decline in the transport segment. It actually went down by about 41%. So we had a significant write back coming from that. What percentage of the loan book is the online facilities? Right now, it's about 23%. If you go to slide 13, it shows a breakdown of the funding sources for the bank. So you will see that on-lending facilities from a liability perspective moved from 191 billion to 235 billion. That 235 billion is what we've taken in terms of total on-lending facilities, both BOI, state bailout funds. You take that as a percentage of the gross loan book, which is about $1.05 trillion. So it's roughly about 23% of the loan book. It's funded by on-lending facilities. Okay, in terms of the growth in time deposits, if you look at growth in the local currency loan book over the period, you will see that there was a growth of about 108 billion in the local currency loan book. Now, if you look at the growth in terms of on-lending facilities over the period, you will see about 43 billion. So when you look at the gap, we've obviously taken some of the term deposits and lent it directly to customers. Out of the growth in the loan book, about 43 billion out of that is coming from on lending facilities. That is for the Naira loan book. For the dollar loan book, about 22 billion out of the growth of 41 billion is coming from other borrowings. Those are FCY borrowings we have with counterparties. Now, in terms of the growth in the fair value reserves, we had a revaluation of some of the investments that we carry in our books. So when the auditors come in, they do a revaluation of the investments we carry at each point in time. And there was a change in the value of those investments over the period from about 7 billion to about 17 billion. From about 7 billion to about 17 plus billion. So that's what led to the fair value reserve. If you look at the financials, it clearly shows the list of those investments that we're holding on that investment portfolio. Thank you.
Our next question is from Olabisi Ayodechi of Telema.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the presentation. I just wanted to clarify, could you please clarify whether the loan growth to the manufacturing segment has been driven by CAPEX projects? Have you gotten a sense of whether that started to pick up recently? Secondly, on NIMS, you did mention that you expect some pressure on asset yields and an increase in funding costs. So I just wanted to get a better sense of how it is that you expect to achieve the NIM guidance compared to where you are as of the first half of the year. And thirdly, I wondered if you could please give a sense of the spread that Fidelity currently makes on the intervention loans from on-lending facilities and maybe compare that to other sorts of assets. That's all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So the manufacturing loans, there are two bits of it. There's a chunk of it driven by CAPEX. Obviously, you have some of the companies that are expanding and using the intervention funds to expand. There's also the bit that is the trade bit of the business, which is people in the FMCG businesses who are important. So it's a mix of both of them. The second question was on so on our NIM guidance. For Q3, we've seen obvious pressure from a lending perspective in terms of banks wanting to meet the 60% threshold. So we've seen customers being offered far lower interest rates, but we're seeing a reversal of that now, obviously because the yields on the OMO instruments are also going up. And that's why we said on this slide that we expect there to be some funding pressure, but we also expect the yields on fixed income securities to increase in Q4 in view of the higher maturities. We believe that with those increase in those yields, it will moderate some of the pressures we're seeing from a lending perspective by the time we get into Q4, and that should be positive for us. Remember, in our own scenario, we are not under pressure to go out and create a lot of new loans. It's more about defending the market share on the customers we've had. And I think so far, so good, we've done that fairly well. Now, in terms of the spread, I think there are three types of these loans in terms of the intervention funds. There are those who get the funding directly from the developmental agencies, and basically what you make is a guarantee fee, and then the commissions you make on the trade and all that. The second is the one that you collect the money directly from the for the intervention funds, and then you on-lend to the customers. On that, you basically have a spread of about 4 to 7%. And then the third of those are those that you collect the money directly, and then you are lending it directly to the customers. In terms of the spread compared to other loan types, it has a lower spread compared to other loan types, but in this scenario, what you have to look at is you can't only look at the spread. You've got to look at, is the customer able to pay you back if you are lending to him at a commercial rate? And for some of these customers, the only way that CAPEX will be viable is if they were borrowing at this concessionary rate. At the normal commercial rate, they might not be able to do those CAPEX expansion that will lead to an improvement in their sales volumes in future years. So For a lot of the customers, what we've seen is they've used this, and I'll just give an example. A customer that takes an intervention fund at 9%, their total finance cost over a three-year period is less than 30%. Now, if you compare that, if the customer has to take a commercial rate at 22% or 23%, over the same three-year period, the total financing cost is inching towards 70%. So it's a very massive difference, which makes a whole lot to the customers. So for terms of backward integration, we've seen a lot of customers take advantage of this. Obviously, the funds are not unlimited, and at a point in time, what is available will pay out. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to clarify, would it be fair to then say that there's been a pickup in CAPEX spending from manufacturers? Because I believe that was a bit of a drag on loan growth last year and earlier in the year as well. So are you seeing a bit of a turnaround in that trend, Q2, Q3?
Well, manufacturing is broad, yeah. So there are different areas of manufacturing. So, for example, people making noodles are manufacturing. Producing water. You know, people are producing plastic bottles. So I'll say in some segments we've seen an uptick, but I think those are segments that, you know, two things we've seen. There are customers who are now producing products that are local substitutes for what some of the known brands used to produce before. Obviously, because of the pricing pressure and the lower disposable income of the consumer, we've seen a migration towards value brands, just because there's a lower consumer disposable income. Customers who play in that segment, we've seen an uptick in demand from those customers simply because the consumers are squeezed, and so it's now more of a pricing decision, and they're going for value brands. Thank you.
Okay, understood. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, just a reminder, if anyone else would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. We have a follow-up question from Tolu Alamutu.
Great. Just to clarify on costs, please. I'd asked earlier about your cost-income ratio for the full year and what measures the bank is putting in place to make sure that that ratio improves, please, because it was over 90% for the second quarter. Thank you.
Okay, so for full year, we're still focused on trying to get it below 70%. Obviously, that's going to be a combination of two things, higher revenue and then keeping the cost growth in check. If you look at some of the lines that have been responsible for the cost growth over this period, NDIC has been one of them, AMCON is one of them. Those basically come with the growth in the business. So for some of those lines, the only way to cushion that cost growth is to have a higher revenue profile, because you can't control it in terms of keeping it under check, except you are not expanding your annual asset base or you're not growing your deposit base. So we believe for Q3 and Q4, we should see an improvement in CIR. The major preoccupation for us is getting it below 70% for the end of the financial year. It will be quite challenging, but that's what we intend to focus on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, just a final reminder, if anyone would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. We have a follow-up question from Olabisi Ayodechi.
Hi. Okay, so I just wanted to clarify quickly. You mentioned that the spread on the on-lending loans is around 47%. Could you please give a range for commercial loans? And could you also speak to where you expect most of your growth for the next 12 months or so to come more from, more commercial loans or on-lending loans? Thank you.
So for commercial loans, it's quite varied depending on the sector, you know, the person is playing in. It could range from 8 to about 14, depending on the sector. And when you look at the fact that blended average funding cost is 6.6%, and then for the commercial segment, you start lending from the high end at about, you know, 17, 18, down to about 23, 24. In terms of where is the loan growth going to come from? Is it the commercial space or the online space? If you look at our guidance for the year, was actually 7.5% to 10%. So right now we're on 17.6%. While we're not going to slow down, obviously you're not going to see an aggressive increase in the loan growth between now and the end of the financial year. So we don't expect to have a loan growth of 35% by the end of the financial year. I haven't done 17.6% in H1. If we repeat the same thing in H2, then we'll be having a growth of 35%. Obviously, we don't intend to have that. So loan growth will be slower in the next two quarters, even though from an absolute growth perspective, that might change depending on how we're able to defend our existing market share of existing loans. But it will not be as steep as the first half of the year. Thank you.
The next question is from Adaronke Akinsola of Chapel Hill Denham.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking my question. So my question is on the recoveries, and I apologize if you touched on this earlier. So I would like to know if you expect similar recoveries in the second half of the year, and would your cost of risk guidance still be 1.25% considering, you know, what had happened as at the first half? So how are you seeing impairments in the second half, basically? That's my question.
Okay. Obviously, we don't expect to see the same pace of impairment write-backs that we saw in H1 in H2. Obviously, we also don't expect there to be a massive escalation in the cost of risk. Like we said earlier, out of the 5.5 billion you see as a gross impairment write-back, if you take out the net loss on the recognition of the financial assets, it will be 1.5 billion. Comparing that to the net charge last year, which was about 2.5 billion, that's still a marked growth. So over the next 6 months, we don't expect to see an impairment right back of about 1.5 billion gross on the book. Are we changing our cost of risk guidance? No. We leave it at 1.25%. It's a very dynamic market. Obviously, we don't think we will keep that guidance based on the way we've seen the asset book play out, but we'll leave the guidance at 1.25%. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, just a follow-up question. So where do you think the cost of risk would likely settle by the end of the year? 0.5%, 0.8%, 1%? Where would you, you know, likely pitch yourself for the cost of risk?
Below 1.25%.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We will pause a moment to see if we have any further questions. It seems we have no further questions on the line, sir. Would you like to make any closing comments?
Thank you all for joining this call. Once again, we reiterate that we'll continue to implement our strategies and hope to achieve our year numbers, and that's why we're staying with our guidance. So on that note, I thank you for participating in this call, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.